This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Now, we're cooking with gas. We're at a bed and breakfast in Santa Barbara called the Eagle Inn. It's just a few blocks away from the wharf. When it's booked solid, the staff is cooking up the most important meal of the day for more than 60 people.
We make scrambled eggs, bacon, and then on the weekends we'll do waffles and crepes and pancakes and all the sweet stuff that people really seem to dig.
Paul Bullock owns the inn. He says he loves cooking with natural gas.
And so we have this stove with a gas stove with two burners and a griddle and oven.
It switches on and off fast. The heat spreads out evenly. He can flip pancakes on top and cook quiche on the bottom. So when Bullock heard about a change that Santa Barbara was considering, he grew concerned. City Council plans to fully electrify all new construction, which means new houses wouldn't be allowed to install this snazzy stove that Paul Bullock loves, or gas heats, or gas-powered hot water. Supporters of the plan say banning new natural gas lines is crucial if the state wants to meet its ambitious climate goals. But in Southern California, where storms and wildfires and wind can knock out power in an instant, is it smart to rely on electricity alone? KCRW's Catherine Barnes takes it from here.
First off, it's important to stress this point. The Santa Barbara City Council is considering banning natural gas in new buildings only. In other words, if you love your gas stove, don't worry. No one's going to show up and take it away. More than 40 cities in California have already put in similar regulations, nearly all of them in the northern part of the state. Leah Stokes is an assistant professor at UC Santa Barbara, where she works on energy policy.
It really is a smart idea to bake this into buildings at the beginning, because then we don't have to retrofit more places, because eventually we are going to have to get off fossil fuels.
Paul Bullock at the Eagle Inn understands the urgency when it comes to our climate crisis, but he's worried about the immediate effects this ban would have on new home and business owners.
It's not a secret that electricity is more expensive to operate, and it's not a secret that here in Santa Barbara we have power shutoffs and rolling blackouts and times where we have no electricity.
These are the two main sticking points that often come up: grid reliability and price. Let's start with the grid. When it's dry outside, as it often is in California, and winds start to whip, the state's electrical suppliers have begun shutting off the power to prevent wildfires.
A spokesperson for the utility company says it's hard to say how long the outages will last.
And that's not to mention when fires themselves knock out the power, or storms, or mudslides. So if you rely on electricity to charge, heat, and cool everything in your house, and it goes out, what are you left with? City Council member Kristen Sneddon is well aware of this concern. She teaches earth science at Santa Barbara City College and sees the issue of grid reliability as a self-perpetuating loop.
The issues with the electrical grid right now being unreliable has to do with climate change and the extreme weather events we're having, and drought and becoming a tinderbox, basically.
In other words, burning natural gas is fueling climate change, which is fueling extreme weather events, which is fueling our need to shut off the electrical grid. You can look at Texas's freak winter storm as the most recent example, which left millions of people without power. Councilmember Sneddon says we need to combat that issue by decentralizing our electricity system. She wants to see more community microgrids, more solar panels on people's roofs, and more batteries in people's homes. That's what she did at her own house.
Yeah, we were finally able to install solar with the battery, and then we got extra battery storage just because I myself really like to be self-reliant. And these power shutoffs they're getting to be too much. But I will acknowledge it's expensive.
Which brings us to the second major sticking point, price. Dennis Allen opens the door into his home. He owns a construction company in Santa Barbara, where he specializes in green building. His house is all electric. He invested in solar panels, motorized awnings, and modern electric appliances like an induction stove. It wasn't cheap to build, but he says the extra expenses paid off over time.
Well, we just got our annual electrical bill, We get it once a year because we're net metered, and it was $143, and we're all electric. So even though some of the appliances are a little more expensive, and they're coming down all the time because they're becoming more prevalent, you make that up pretty rapidly with either greatly reduced or zero utility bills.
Plus, he says his induction stove is fabulous. We head into the kitchen so he can show it off.
I'll put this on so you can see how fast it boils. I'll put it back here so it's on the smaller burner.
Although it uses electricity, this isn't your old school coil stove from the 1950s. Induction cooktops use magnets to distribute heat for a more precise cooking experience. As we wait for the pot of water to boil, Alan lists off the pros of his stove.
The cleanup. You can see it's a single surface that you just wipe off with a sponge. And you know, I can put my hand right here next to it and I won't get burned. Because I'm not, I could put an ice cube here and it won't melt. But I think with a burner is on and you don't have a pot on it for a minute, it'll automatically shut off. So again, another safety feature.
3 minutes spent watching a pot boil and it's fully bubbling. But not everyone is sold on induction. Some people are afraid of products that let off electric and magnetic radiation, like microwaves and cell phones, and don't want to add more into their homes. But according to the World Health Organization, most studies have found that the radiation from induction is weak enough not to threaten human health, though it admits more research must be done. And what about all those professional chefs like Paul Bullock, who just really love gas and can't imagine cooking on anything else? Alan says if they tried induction, their minds might change. In fact, celebrity chef Curtis Stone is a huge fan. He cooks on induction at two of his restaurants in L.A., Maud in Beverly Hills and Gwen in Hollywood.
I love induction because it's super easy to clean. It uses way less energy and it brings something to a boil up to 50% faster.
He's still got a lot of minds to change in the chef community. And in a place like Santa Barbara, where tourism is king, pushback from the hospitality industry may lead council to ban gas in new residential buildings, but hold off on commercial ones. In the meantime, the city's natural gas provider, SoCalGas, isn't going down without a fight. A front group for the company sent text messages to residents urging them to oppose the measure. And natural gas trade groups pay Instagram influencers to rave about their gas stoves. Leah Stokes, the energy policy professor at UC Santa Barbara, says she doesn't want her gas bill to fund that type of manipulative behavior.
And since they're a monopoly, we can't choose, you know, whether or not they do these things. It's not like we can buy from a different company. The only real choice is to exit and to electrify your home.
SoCalGas declined to be interviewed. Instead, the company sent a statement saying that the gas grid is essential for maintaining an affordable, reliable, and resilient energy system. Santa Barbara's City Council is set to vote on the ordinance in April. For KCRW, I'm Catherine Barnes.
Well, as reporter Catherine Barnes just mentioned, the natural gas industry has been doing a lot of social media influencing lately and all-out advertising blitzes for decades. Like this ad campaign, complete with catchy jingle from the 1980s.
Clean, efficient, and in most areas, the lowest priced fuel. Shouldn't it be in your home?
Nothing more to like gas.
In more recent years, on Instagram, hashtag cooking with gas is a sponsored ad that usually accompanies a pristine pic of a smiling someone cooking in an Architectural Digest approved kitchen, complete with giant gas stove. And it's not just in your social feeds, it's also on your local next door posts. Just last year, a PR firm account manager posed as a Culver City resident and instigated a heated debate over fears that the city would ban gas in a community thread. One of the firm's clients was actually a front group for SoCalGas, the same group that sent those text messages to residents in Santa Barbara. Rebecca Lieber is a reporter at Mother Jones, where she's been covering how the fossil fuel industry has been messaging the country for years, and she's here to talk about it. Hey, Rebecca.
Hi, it's great to be on.
All right. Well, I want to start with this hashtag cooking with gas, which, by the way, has been a line since the 1930s, right? Tell us more about who posts with hashtag cooking with gas and what they look like?
Yeah, so the phrase cooking with gas, I think it's pretty pervasive in our culture, but it was actually invented by the gas industry as a way to market natural gas stoves. So today we see this new iteration of this very old campaign where the gas industry is targeting social media influencers. And I found in my reporting that influencers on Instagram, on YouTube, were being paid through sponsored posts to promote cooking with, quote, natural gas. And this is a technique to really promote gas as this and gas cooking as this aspirational, stylish lifestyle. I think you see that really embodied by targeting these young women to turn the gas stove into this aspiration. And we see that really permeate in our culture, too, where there's this mythology really built around gas cooking that it's the only way you can cook.
You say young women, and I wonder, I mean, we're talking about millennials, right? And we're talking about influencers on social media who have thousands of followers on Instagram for sure. And there they are, you know, spatula with hand, making pancakes or making omelets with their frying pans, and they look like they're having so much fun. And I wonder, why do you think that these trade groups are targeting young women, as you just mentioned?
So women are a key demographic, and I don't mean to say it's the only demographic that the industry wants to target, but there are a few reasons I think we see women really becoming a target for fossil fuel industry. One is that women, speaking broadly, are a very key voting demographic. We see this throughout politics that and in the industry's own internal presentations that they talk about women as a key demographic that they need to convince to use fossil fuels to ensure the future, because women generally, polling wise, care more about environment and climate change. This is really key for the industry. The other reason I think has to do with buying power, and this is where we see the marketing through the decades. In the 1950s and 60s, I found newspaper ads starring celebrities paid by the gas industry to promote gas cooking. There was this incredible TV ad that the gas industry ran showing actresses plotting to convince their husbands to remodel their kitchen using gas cooking. So while that's pretty dated, I'm not saying it always works, but it's certainly an important strategy for them.
This thing on Nextdoor really raised my eyebrow. Happened in our own backyard. It was a PR company employee who posed as a Culver City resident. And that created this tension and a lot of hot air about, hey, Culver City is going to get rid of, you know, gas in homes. And, you know, that seems a little more insidious.
Yeah, so I think infiltrating social media, this is a whole new age of misinformation, and we see how industries are capitalizing on how easy it is to pose as someone else on social media. So this Nextdoor example, a PR representative for a company that was working on behalf of SoCalGas, the nation's largest gas utility, went on Nextdoor to warn fellow residents of a ban on gas stoves that Culver City was considering. Now, that, to begin with, was misinformation because they were talking about new buildings and gas hookups, not taking away the stove from your kitchen. But we see how the gas industry has tried to infiltrate communities to raise this alarmist rhetoric that you will lose your stove if you side with environmentalists. Now, that's not true, but the industry has used social media to its advantage to turn gas stoves into this wedge issue in climate battles throughout the country. So in Culver City, as you can expect, once this man posted warning about the gas stove, members of the community chimed in, some very concerned, some sticking up for alternatives to gas. And to this date, Culver City has still not pursued those tougher standards on gas. And while you can't say this one social media post was responsible, I think the reasons you see some cities facing roadblocks or not going as far as they could is because of this kind of opposition that the industry is really cultivating.
What did the PR firm, Rebecca, this PR firm called Imprenta Communications, what did they say about the incident? And what about SoCal Gas? What are they saying about this whole thing?
So when I went to Imprenta with screenshots of this Nextdoor post, they confirmed the incident to me, saying that an employee went on Nextdoor, even though they were charged with finding an actual member of the community, to post something similar. So they confirmed it to me. They said this was an isolated incident, thanked me for bringing it to their attention, and said SoCal Gas was no longer a client. Now, there are a few things to remember here. One thing I found in my reporting was the gas utility SoCal Gas and its front group, Californians for Balanced Energy Solutions, was exploring tactics like Nextdoor to generate community opposition. So that was one thing I confirmed in my reporting. Second, SoCal Gas is under a state investigation for allegedly using ratepayer funds for these campaigns to oppose electrification. So there is currently an investigation into SoCal Gas, including Imprenta and other PR groups, for helping SoCal Gas in its efforts to fight these climate efforts. So this is just the tip of the iceberg here. That's one thing to remember. Even though Imprenta said this was an isolated incident, I don't think you see this as an isolated incident in these anti-electrification campaigns we see throughout the country.
Do you have a sense, Rebecca, that these online campaigns work?
Well, I think our best evidence of how they work is how prevalent this mythology is around the gas stove. People feel so strongly attached to these stoves, and I think you can't isolate it from this century-long campaign promoting the stove. So I think that's one sign of the industry success in building up the stove as this necessary technology. But on top of that, in fighting these electrification battles across the country, we see a momentum for cities moving towards electrification. Already 42 cities have modernized their building codes to phase out gas. But at the same time, this fight's just ramping up. So there has been, in some instances, community opposition. I think we saw that in Santa Barbara, where the industry sent robotechs pushing residents to oppose electrification. So this fight is just ramping up. We're going to see 2021 as a really big year and turning point for the gas industry.
Rebecca Lieber, reporter at Mother Jones, where she covers environmental policy and politics. Rebecca, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Here's dinner in a movie.
I'm going to leave first. And then when the time is right, like when the maitre d's not looking, you meet me down the street.
Hey, run, 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 run!
That's a fun romantic scene about stealing from the film The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby. People have been dining and dashing for as long as there have been restaurants. But during much of the pandemic, when a lot of restaurants only offered takeout, you'd think it'd be pretty hard to dine and dash. Actually, dine and dash, or at least a version of it, is alive and well. Jen Harris is newly named as a food columnist for the LA Times, and she wrote a story about today's dine and dash, and she's here to talk about it. Hey, Jen.
Hi, how's it going?
Congratulations, by the way, on your new role at the Times as columnist.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
What is the pandemic version of the dine and dash?
So what's happening is There are people who are taking advantage of restaurants that have, you know, prioritized safety over in-person security measures that they would normally have, such as, you know, checking someone's driver's license or manually swiping a credit card. You know, they're trying to keep everything as contactless as possible.
Right.
So what's happening is people are using fraudulent credit card numbers. Other people are requesting refunds for food that's already been delivered. And some people are even claiming they never received part of or all of an order.
That's not to say, of course, there aren't problems with orders sometimes, right? I mean, it can get a little messy when you order something to go or something comes to your house. There's a lot of confusion sometimes. So we want to separate that from people who are purposely doing these kinds of things.
Yes, and a lot of the restaurants I talked to, they said, you know, once in a while they'll forget to put an order of something in an order, and then, you know, the customer will call and they'll say, hey, you know, it'll be free next time or we'll send it out to you now. But most of what we're seeing happening is an increase in people claiming that fraudulently.
You start your piece, Jen, with a story from the restaurant Spoon by H. This is a Korean place in the Fairfax district. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, so the owner there, Yunjin Huang, was telling me about an incident that happened late last year, just before the holidays. She received a very large order. It was for over $700. When someone came to pick up the order, they gave the name on the order. They didn't, however, include their vehicle information, which is what Yunjin asks for when you place your order, just so they can keep everything contactless. The vehicle pulls up, and then she can just kind of bring it out and put it in your trunk. But instead, the person showed up without the vehicle information. She offered to help him bring the food to his car. It was many bags. He had parked like his van way down the street. And again, there were certain things that were suspicious about the order, but because business had been slow and because she was so excited to get such a large order, she said, okay, maybe I'm just overthinking this.
Yeah.
So she gives him the food. And then a couple weeks later, she receives a message from Talk, which is the third-party service she uses for some of her orders, letting her know that the customer was disputing the $720.76 charge and that the payment had been removed from her account. So she then started to dispute the fraudulent charge and, you know, provided photo evidence, but unfortunately she lost it. Also, unfortunately, apparently this is one of many instances of this happening to her. She said that over the past 6 months, she's had multiple chargebacks and disputed charges. And, you know, that in addition to her business being slow, just because we're in the middle of a pandemic, it was too much for her to stay open.
If she had photo evidence, I mean, hey, here's me, you know, helping put the food in this van way down the street. How did she lose this?
So she lost this dispute because the person disputing the charge said that someone else had used their credit card, that it wasn't them who went to go get the food. So therefore, you know, they weren't responsible for the charge. And unfortunately, the credit card sided with the person. So even though she had evidence that, you know, she had made this food and delivered this food and given the food to the person, it didn't matter.
What are restaurants doing to combat this kind of fraud?
So Yunjin, before she closed the restaurant just recently, just this past week, she had started taking video of every order pickup to show that somebody, you know, physically came to pick up the food. She was requiring everyone to show their driver's license. But, you know, I've talked to other restaurants who have stopped taking credit card payment over the phone, just requiring everyone to come in physically. So they can no longer keep it contactless and swipe the card physically, show your ID physically, so that there's no question as to someone came in and used that card there.
What about the delivery apps out there? You know, Postmates, DoorDash, Grubhub. They must be aware of this kind of stuff going on, right? I mean, are they doing anything to help?
I mean, there are some apps who say that they will help reimburse the restaurant if someone claims that something is missing. But there are other where, you know, if a customer claims they never received something, they're going to side with the customer and they're going to take that money out of the restaurant's account. So it really just depends on which app a restaurant is working with.
There's certainly a lot going on. I mean, and people, unfortunately, sadly, take advantage of situations such as a pandemic, and restaurants are already hurting. I want to thank you for at least bringing some light to it. Jen Harris, food columnist for the LA Times. Thanks for sharing your time with us.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
That's all for now. Join us next week as we tackle the future of automobiles. Electric cars are certainly becoming the rage. But what about the infrastructure for those? And what about other types of cleaner cars? Also, our Wasted series wraps up. Could buying fewer things be the answer? You probably know the answer to that. But how do you do that? Hope you'll join us next week. You can hear the show whenever you want at kcrw.com/greaterLA and subscribe to the podcast. Check in with us. Tell us how you're doing these days, too, and tell us how we're doing. Share your thoughts with us at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamat, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Tom, Mario Saavedra, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordahl. We're all here putting this show together. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for your ears and time this evening. Have yourself a great night.